It is essential that the leaders in the Middle East speak out clearly against violence. We must break the cycle of violence in order to begin meaningful discussions about any kind of political settlement.
So this was all before some of the serious talk about an invasion of Iraq got underway, right?
Well, there clearly was, at that time, had already been talk about an invasion into Iraq. You know, that was certainly ongoing at that time.
We must break the cycle of violence. It is essential. 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 It is essential.
Carry on until the job is done.
Enjoy your freedom when you've lost your child. When hurt captures your heart, you're a prisoner for life. Killing the beast doesn't ease the pain. Hate and never run long.
on until the job is done.
It is essential.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with David K. Johnston talking about how big companies use plain English to rob you blind. And then it goes on to historian Claiborne Carson talking with Tavis Smiley.
On Book TV afterwards with guest host USA Today's money reporter Jane O'Donnell. This week, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston's new release, The Fine Print. In his latest expose, the best-selling author of Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch reveals the surprisingly numerous ways in which corporations, he says, systematically exploit their customers and the government.
David, it seems to me the basic contention in your book is that we're all getting taken by corporations and the government's pretty much letting them get away with it.
Yes.
People often say to reporters like you and I that, oh, well, you're just doing, these are the worst case examples. It's really not as bad as you describe. But I bet there's probably more examples. Did you have trouble filling this book?
No, I have enough material. I could do another book and maybe two more books.
On this very same theme, right?
On the same theme about what's going on. And unfortunately, we need to keep in mind what Adam Smith taught when he wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776. You know, seldom do businessmen gather together even for merriment, but the talk turns to a conversation against the public interest to raise prices and lower wages. And what I document in the fine print is how a number of big corporations have tried to thwart the rigors of market competition, mm-hmm. create monopolies and duopolies and oligopolies, artificially raise prices, provide very poor service compared to some industries, other countries of the world, and in a few cases, literally put lives at risk, and how we don't have a balanced system focused on competitive markets.
Mm-hmm. We'll go through some of these specific examples, and I think everybody that talks to you probably has their favorites that jumped out
sure.
at them. But to you, what was the most egregious? What stands out to you as being the most egregious, and tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I think the single most egregious story in the book is about a man named Bob Manning. Bob Manning was a 26-year-old lineman for the electric power company in upstate New York, Niagara Mohawk. And one day in February of 1962, as he was coming down off a power pole, a bolt of electricity got loose, and he went headfirst into the pavement, paralyzed from the neck down. And I met Bob in 1997 when he called the New York Times looking for help because he couldn't collect his workers' compensation benefits 35 years later. But that's not the really egregious story I tell in this book. The really egregious story is that the power company was sold. The insurance company that had his claim, which was owned by a bunch of utilities, was then sold. And they had a finding that there were no cases of refusal to pay benefits. The New York State Insurance Department. I actually called them about that. And I said, did you not read the front page of the New York Times? Did you not read what Governor Pataki said? And they went, well, we don't pay any attention to what's in the newspapers. And I said, well, what about all the complaints by this man? And they said, yeah, but he never got a final judicial ruling that they'd refused to pay him. So they gave him a walk after refusing all these years to pay. They did ultimately pay some of the money he was owed. And then the insurance policy was bought by Colin Ree, a Warren Buffett company. And a nurse comes around, ingratiating herself into Bob Manning's life in Sacramento, California, where he had moved. And eventually she goes to his home, which they have a right to do, to inspect. And the Mannings are these wonderful people who, they adopted three children from a relative where the parents were killed. Uh-huh. And they're just marvelous human beings. One of the sons grew up to become an airline pilot. And this nurse goes into Bob's room and points to the wall and says, why don't you have a DNR? A DNR means do not resuscitate. You know, why are you having the medics try to keep you alive when you have one of your medical emergencies, which happens all the time to people in this condition? In effect, asking him to die. And, you know, Bob's wife, Bob, his nurse, his doctor, all the people who saw the nurse do this and her other actions were just appalled by this. Well, you know, Warren Buffett didn't know about this and wouldn't approve of it in the least. On the other hand, what does Mr. Buffett say about his companies? So long as my managers make their numbers, I let them run the businesses as they see fit. Mm-hmm. And it's indicative of the callousness that's going on where we don't have balance, and we're so focused on profits that you literally can have a company go and say, please die.
You know, but when we talk about, in your book, you talk a lot about some of these industries have been deregulated. And often, certainly in this presidential campaign, people think about regulation in terms of a Democrat versus Republican.
Right.
issue. But were more of these laws, like, were more of the problems created because of Democrats or because of Republicans, or is this not a party-related issue?
This is not a partisan issue. There is one party in Washington. It's the party of money. There's one party in the state capitals. It's the party of money. And frankly, if you or I were elected to Congress, we'd have to behave like every member of Congress does, because if we want to get reelected, which means we have to listen to the people who are going to provide the money to pay for the campaigns for us to run for office. And it's not going to be Joe Sixpack and Mary Smith. It's going to be representatives of big corporations and wealthy individuals who all come pleading, I just need a little change here that'll be fair. What they really want to do is unlevel the playing field and thwart the rigors of the market. And by the way, there's no such thing as deregulation. There is only re-regulation. There's only new regulation. So what we've done is taken regulations. I'm not going to defend every regulation, but we took a regulatory scheme that was balanced, that looked at the interests of companies and looked at the interests of customers and other parties, and replaced it with a system of the corporations by the corporations that takes away consumer rights. Everything is regulated. You know, I like to say baseball regulates right down to how many stitches are on the ball and what color the yarn is. Everything is regulated. And most of the regulations that are in the federal code of regulations in the state, they were sought by corporations. Business seeks regulation both to define the playing field, but more importantly, to try and prevent competitors and escape the rigors of competitive markets.
Mm-hmm. Often writing the regulations.
In many cases, regulations and statutes are actually written by the companies. That's right.
That's always interesting to see. And people would never believe that, but it happens all the time.
But you, having worked in Washington many years, you've seen it. Well, everybody who works near the sausage factory has seen that's what happens.
And the advocacy groups do it, too. Everyone's in on it. they're all drafting.
It is, although the advocacy groups have a lot less power and influence than the corporations.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, less money. So you refer, a couple of the powerful phrases in the book to me were you refer to ours being a rigged economy.
Yes.
You've kind of touched on that, but if you could explain a little more clearly.
Well, in a competitive market, government would set the rules and, as the Germans do with what they call ordoliberalism, adjust the rules as businesses figure out how to game those rules to try and have as level playing field as possible. You're not going to have perfection, but you want to keep trying to make sure the playing field is level, because the market will figure out best how to allocate capital and who should succeed. But it's also a natural tendency in a capitalist market to tend toward monopoly or duopoly, where a couple of very successful firms keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and removing competition. And when that happens, what you get is stultification. You know, once you're a monopoly or a duopoly, you don't want to invest in innovation. You don't want to take risks. You just want to mine the market. You want to do what economists call rent seeking, by which they mean earning profits greater than you would get in a market economy. When you add to that all of these rules and regulations that in the book, and every chapter, I'm sure you read things you have not read in the news media.
No.
I show how again and again and again the market is being rigged. This is terrible for our national economy in the long run. It helps explain why we're in these economic doldrums and why we don't have the job creation we should be having.
So let's go through some of the examples. Maybe we'll touch on a few of my favorites, and then get back to some of the ones you might have stood out more for you, other than that awful story about Bob Mann that I'll never forget as long as I live. How about the internet? The fact that do I have this right? So we have the highest prices in the world, and we're 29th in speed and. Explain how did that come to be?
We invented the internet in America,
right?
It was taxpayers who paid to invent it. It was set up by academics and the military through the what's now called DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And so we began at number one. And back in the 90s, Al Gore, as a senator and vice president and others, promoted this idea that we would have this wondrous thing called the internet. And when browsers came along in 1995, it meant that geeks weren't the only people who could use it. You can have what we all know today as the internet. The telephone companies and the cable companies all went to Capitol Hill and the state legislatures and said, we're going to build this fabulous thing. And there was this great television ad that ran in 1999 that I tell about, where an old geezer, sort of like me but thin, pulls into this flea bag motel, drops his satchel, says to the young woman behind the desk, rooms, king-size beds. Room service, coffee and donuts in the lobby. Entertainment, she looks at him and says, every movie ever made in every language, in every room.
Yes.
That's what we were promised. Yeah. And this was shot at Roy's Cafe and Motel in the Mojave Desert. Well, the rest of the world is doing that. the internet is being made universal in all these other places. America ranks 29th now in the speed of its internet, behind such leading industrial lights of the world as Moldavia and Ukraine. Moldova and Ukraine.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
We pay the highest prices in the world by far. By one measure, we pay 38 times what the Japanese pay per bit of information. If you buy one of these triple play packages, and I have one in my home, you pay on average with taxes in the U.S. $160. In France, you pay $38 U.S., and you get worldwide calling to 70 countries, not just the U.S. and Canada. You get worldwide television, not just domestic, and your internet is 20 times faster uploading and 10 times faster downloading, and you're paying less than 25 cents on the dollar. All these other countries understand a fundamental principle. In the 19th century, canals and railroads were the key to economic growth as industrialization came along and you had to move heavy things like steel. As the 20th century came along, it was highways, the Interstate Highway Program, for example, and airports that were crucial to economic growth. Now it's the information superhighway. And what does the industry say? Oh, don't call it that anymore. And the reason is, the rest of the world is getting an information superhighway.
Did someone literally say that to you?
Oh, yeah. I was literally told by the chief PR person at Verizon that was a hoary phrase and really not used anymore. And that's the only company that actually has fiber optic to your home. AT&T has fiber optic, but not to your home. It just runs down the street. But the companies are not wiring the whole country the way these other countries are. Universal access of a really high-speed internet would lead to products and services. I can't even imagine what they are, but if you build it, they will come. That's why these other countries are doing this. And we're going to be left in the dust economically. And then these companies went to the state legislatures, and they got all these little changes in the law that I tell about that said, well, you don't have to provide service to everybody. I mean, very few Americans know that since 1913, they've had a legal right to a telephone at any address. Five states have repealed that law. I think it's Florida, Alabama, Texas, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. I can't find a single newspaper clip telling you this. I called advocacy groups who deal with people, things like lifeline access for disabled and poor people. They go, what? We didn't hear that happen. So the news media is not...
that are getting cell service either, probably.
Well,
if they're that far away, that they're not getting a landline.
And one of the arguments that's made is, well, you know, we don't have a monopoly anymore. We have these competing services. There's cable companies, telephone companies, cell phone companies. First of all, a cell phone is not the equivalent of these other services. Mm-hmm. But under the rules they've passed in many places, you could have a cable company and a phone company with cable of some kind, coax or fiber optic, running down your street. They just refuse to serve you. You live in an apartment building with 100 units and only 40 people want service.
Right.
We're not going to wire your building.
Right.
And the proof of that is there's a building in North Jersey that has not been wired for 4 years. That building has, among its residents, the chief ratepayer advocate for the state of New Jersey. Now, when I wrote about that, I thought, well, surely some executive at Verizon will say, that's kind of not politically smart to do. Go figure out how to get these people to wire their building. They wanted to see the wiring plans to the building because it's a lovely building and they didn't want damage done to it. And they were told, no, we don't negotiate. We'll punch holes where we want to. They didn't do anything. That's how much power these companies have. And if the chief ratepayer advocate for the state of New Jersey can't get fiber optic service, what hope do you, I, or anybody listening have as these laws are rewritten to take away your rights and vest all the power in the companies and then cut out the state regulators who were there to protect you?
Mm-hmm. And I want to get to this at the end, but in that particular example, I mean, what would you tell a consumer that's in that situation? I know you recommend that people get more involved politically and write letters to the editor, but what can you do about it?
Well, this book has a lot of solutions. Unlike Perfectly Legal, which was about taxes, and Freelance, which was about subsidies, I was at the New York Times then, and the New York Times position was that to write solutions is to express a bias. So This book has lots of proposed solutions for what to do about it. But all three of these books end with the same sentence. Reform begins with you. My job as a journalist is to dig this stuff out of the record, do the investigative work that's needed, explain it to you so you can understand it. Now it's your job to go do something about it or live with the consequences of it.
But
that's the idea of a democracy.
If you were living in the building in New Jersey, what would you do personally?
First of all, I'd be complaining to the company everywhere I could.
Yeah.
I would go to the state legislature and say, you know, I'm sorry, we have this nice, beautiful building. Your position is they can just punch holes with no regard for our property, no regard for our property rights, or we don't get service. I mean, I would make noise with the legislature and get their attention. And, you know, most of the lawmakers who pass these things, both federal and state, they have no idea what they're doing. They don't read the bills. They never have. They never will.
They rely on the ramifications of
that's right. And they do what their, you know, their staff says, well, this is what this bill is about, or the leadership sends around a note. And only a handful of people actually get in and learn what these things are about. Right. And if there's no pushback, if there aren't consumer groups, government-funded organizations that are supposed to look out for the consumer, as well as private groups, then you get this one-sided development in the law that undoes ancient principles. And at Syracuse, I teach now one day a week in the law school and the graduate school of business, and I teach the history of these things, property and tax in one class and business regulation in the other. We start with Hammurabi's code. Everything in the law today pretty much is in Hammurabi's code, from social insurance to business regulation to rules on loans to defenses for white-collar crimes and how to test them. And these laws were developed out of thousands of years of experience. What we're seeing now is these big corporations very quietly, with nobody noticing, undoing thousands of years of human experience to their benefit and to the detriment of the overall economy.
Is there a solution with the state legislature? Should they be year-round? Should they be paid more? Should the lobbying restrictions be greater?
Well, this is a real difficult problem. It strikes me that one of the solutions we should be having an active discussion about is public financing of elections. The two states that have tried this, Maine and Arizona, it turns out the incumbents tend to get thrown out, which is kind of surprising. The Constitution gives you a right to lobby. The First Amendment says a right to petition for a redress of grievances. Interestingly, it does not require any response by the government. It only requires it to accept the petition. But I don't think the lobbying we're seeing in the state capitals and Washington is what the founders had in mind, because it's accompanied with campaign contributions or the threat of contributions to other people if you don't play ball. And they're the only people who are really being heard. So I think the fundamental reform of the campaign contribution system would be important. In my last book, Free Lunch, I suggested that we should put in place a set of rules that once you're elected to an office like this, you can't go to work for the industries that you were on committees that were involved with. Maybe we should pay you a lifetime pension and sort of remove you from the economy. I suspect, costly as that might be, it would be a lot cheaper than the things we're seeing now that are extracting billions and hundreds of billions of dollars in people's pockets that a market would never allow, and giving them over to these corporations.
You know, back to the telecom industry, the remote control, the profits on the remote control was fascinating to me. Could you go over that? What was the profit? $1,000?
Oh, it's just off the wall. Glasgow, Kentucky, draws its name from Scotland, and of course the Scots are famous for being very tight with a buck.
Right.
They had a monopoly cable provider who was charging them incredible prices, and if you had a little clicker to change channels, or you're sitting on the sofa as a couch potato, it was $5 a month. So they built a municipal system. They were able to cut prices dramatically, still make money on the system, and they cut the price of a remote to less than a dollar. Even at a dollar, they make tremendous money. You can go buy a remote. If you look at very carefully at your cable bill, and you'll notice, like a lot of these bills, is line after line after line of detail to sort of get you to not notice what's really going on. You're probably paying 75 cents a month. They buy these things for a couple of dollars, and the fact that they're worth nothing, when you turn in your cable box, they don't ask you to bring your clicker back.
Right. It's not worth the trip.
That's right. So $5 a month is indicative of, that's price gouging. Mm-hmm. That's charging a rate of return that's thousands of percent over time. And you can do that if you're a monopoly. And to be a monopoly, in most cases, especially in telecommunications, it's because the government lets you be a monopoly.
Mm-hmm. So the company in Glasgow is still there, and it's still
Well, what happened is there was an effort by the company, it was the private company, to sue them out of business. And Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, and the 1996 Telecommunications Act was being debated, set up a group.
Progress
and Freedom Foundation, I think was the name of it. And it was to raise money from the telecom industry to promote what the telecom industry wanted. Not what was in the public good, but what the telecom industry wanted. They then put the system in Glasgow in the red. It was losing money, but only because of the cost of litigation.
That's right.
And when the case came before a well-known, real rock-rib conservative judge, he listened to the industry lawyer, and he leaned down from the bench, and he says, "So it sounds like you just don't want any competition."
Mm-hmm.
Well, since then, Glasgow has modernized its system twice, the municipal system. It charges much lower rates than the surrounding monopoly providers. And the same thing has happened in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Scottsboro, Alabama, and Chattanooga, which has the fastest internet in America.
And now for something completely different.